times. Congress has yet to agree on military spending for the new fiscal year that began in October. The 2012 defense budget was more than $600 billion. While defense spending has grown dramatically in the last decade, the Pentagon faces a reduction of $500 billion over the next decade in a deal worked out a year and a half ago. And if Congress and the White House can't come to an agreement on the so-called fiscal cliff, there will be another $500 billion more in defense spending cuts. So today on Radio Times, we want to take a look at defense spending and the defense budget. Where does all that money go and what can be trimmed without risking national security? And we ask Gordon Adams to join us. He's a professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University. He's also a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. He was in the Clinton administration Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs in the Office of Management and Budget. He writes a regular column for Foreign Policy, has a blog called The Sheathed Sword, say that many times fast, and he writes for The Will and The Wallet. And Gordon Adams, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's nice to be with you again.
So what comes first, an agreement on foreign policy or a budget on foreign policy?
Oh, I think the budget always comes first. There are some people who think that we should be planning foreign policy and strategy independent of how much money it costs. But the truth is, throughout history, the amount that we spend and the foreign policy and defense policy that we have are intimately related. The one is always adjusted to the other. Over the past 10 years, we've increased the defense budget significantly to the point where we're spending more than at any point in our history in constant dollars. So now it's time for the budgetary piper to call a tune, and the major issue that's on the table with Americans is the budget. So the Defense Department, like all other federal departments, and revenues and entitlements are all going to have to some degree, dance to the tune of the fiscal player.
Well, and just going back, I'm looking at some information from the year 2001, just to put our conversation into context. The Pentagon budget in 2001 was $316 billion, and today it's more than $600 billion. Is that because we've been fighting two wars?
Yes, basically, sort of two things have happened. One dragged the other along. We spent probably a trillion, $1.2, $1.3 trillion so far on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, funded most of that through something called supplementals and later the Overseas Contingency Operations Account. Only the Pentagon comes up with these things.
Exactly.
And that has been a $1.2 or $3 trillion train that has pulled the rest of what they call the base defense budget up at the same time. So it's primarily the pull of the wars with the defense budget, the basic defense expenditures following right along, and as you pointed out, more than doubling over the past 10 or 12 years.
And even thinking about all the Marines and soldiers who were injured in that war, the cost of their care, I read, could be as much as $1 trillion.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting, of course, is that's not counted in the defense budget. That spending for veterans' benefits and health care and the like, all of which is now a quite understandable consequence of those deployments, all of that is funded over in the Department of Veterans Affairs in the veterans' budget. And that budget has more than doubled over the past 10 years as well. And we anticipate at least $1 trillion lifetime expenditures for those veterans' benefits over the next 30 or 40 years.
We did reduce defense spending after the Korean War, after the Vietnam War, even after the Cold War. Do you think there's an appetite to do some serious reductions?
There's no question that there's an appetite. What's happening now is what's happened before, as you point out. After Korea, Vietnam, end of the Cold War, the defense budget went down. It's already actually started down. The fiscal 11 budget was below the fiscal 10 budget. 12 was below 11, and it looks very likely that fiscal 13, our current fiscal year for defense, will be below 12. So we're already in a build down, and the reason's pretty straightforward. We're out of Iraq, we're coming out of Afghanistan, public attention drifts away to other things, and when, you know, the other things appear, they are things like the economy and jobs and deficits and debt and health and education, gun control, whatever. And all those things take precedence over the level of defense spending. It's important to keep in mind that we are at a historically unprecedented level. We will be coming down. We've done it before. In fact, every time we've built down, like after Korea or Vietnam or the end of the Cold War, if you started at the most expensive year, the peak year of spending, and went out 10 years, basically, the defense budget comes down about one-third in constant dollars once we've ended those combat operations. So I could anticipate something like that, or maybe a little shallower than that over the next 10 years.
And do you have a number in mind?
Well, what it will look like, and you always have to be careful when budget people talk, because, you know, what's the baseline they're using and where are they talking from? We haven't yet cut the projected defense budget. Secretary Panetta likes to say, he said it yesterday, that he's cut defense $487 billion. From a budget weenie's point of view, he hasn't really done that. What he did was bring the level of growth over the next 10 years down to a budget that was basically flat with inflation. So it hasn't yet been cut out in the future. What we're looking at right now in terms of sequester could be $500 billion over 10 years of real cuts.
Right.
I would think, based on my own experience at OMB in the 90s, that if we turn around 10 years from now and look backwards, we'll say from fiscal year 10, when defense spending was the highest it ever was, out 10 years, if you'd just given the department inflation growth, and then you compared it to what we actually did with defense over the same 10 years, we'll see that the gap between those two things adds up to something like $1 to $1.5 trillion.
Let me quote from Secretary Panetta, and he spoke at the National Press Club yesterday, and I'm just quoting him here, talking about defense spending and some of the choices. He says, nevertheless, there is pressure on the department to retain excess force structure and infrastructure instead of investing in the training and equipment that makes our force agile and flexible and ready. Aircraft, ships, tanks, bases, even those that have outlived their usefulness have a natural political constituency. Readiness does not. What's more, readiness is too often sacrificed in favor of a larger and less effective force. He's saying there's a lot of pressure on him and his department to keep some of these jobs and to keep some of these, I guess, ships and tanks and aircraft that might not be necessary to defend the country in the future.
Yeah, if I listen to what the secretary said, he's pointing to what I consider to be two of the three most significant reasons that, as I like to say, we spend too much on defense.
Right.
And the reason I say that is because we spend a good deal of the defense budget on things that do not directly contribute to combat capability and our security. And Panetta put his fingers on a couple of them. One is not just the size of the force, but how we pay the force and especially how we provide benefits to active duty people and retirees. This is what I call a third rail of politics. I fully expect pushback on this subject. But if you give blanket across-the-board pay raises to everybody in the military, with 1.4 million people in the military, that's very expensive. If you went to rewarding people for good work and good productivity and give them bigger pay raises in merit, you might alter that design. If you give people, you know, a really magnificent health care services for the military, and you expand that to the retirees and the reservists and so on, that's really expensive, as the secretary knows. And we're not asking them to pay very much in terms of the co-pays and deductibles and enrollment fees, all the things that, you know, we normal Americans outside the military pay. The average military family of four pays $520 a year for its health care enrollment fee. The average American family pays 10 times that. So that's a very expensive benefit that's very, very hard to change. And the retirement system is also expensive. So people is one big area that the secretary's put his finger on, and he's right, but it's very hard to change.
Well, let me just jump in here, because I'm sure you've heard this argument, the argument being that if you're in the military, you are in a potential position of sacrificing yourself for the country, and therefore we should reward that kind of behavior with good benefits.
And we do. We, in fact, rewarded with unusually generous benefits. And some of that obviously is justified because you're asking people to do that. Although it's important to keep in mind that not everybody is putting themselves in a position of danger. The Defense Business Board did a study a couple of years ago. This is a Pentagon advisory group. Did a study of the personnel in the Department of Defense. And they came to the conclusion that about a third of the American military force, active duty in service, never deploy. They're basically in the back office. They're running the accounting systems, the financial systems, the base operations, and so on. They're doing the administrative back office job for the Department of Defense. But they're not at the point of the spear. And our point of the spear for the military, the actual people out there in the field taking fire and providing it, and the people who directly support them in the field, are two-thirds of the force, but not the entire force. They call it the tooth-to-tail ratio. That's how much back office do you have for the point of the spear? We have the worst tooth-to-tail ratio in the NATO alliance, of the major powers in the NATO alliance, the biggest back office, relatively speaking, the smallest point of the spear. So it's absolutely true that we ask people to spend their lives, with some of them putting themselves in grave danger. We obviously pay them well. We pay them benefits well. But at this point, it's becoming very expensive. And as the Secretary is pointing out, when you're in a drawdown, when your budget's coming down, it makes it very hard to have the flexibility to make the choices that have to do with your direct combat capability.
But that sounds like an argument to reduce the size of that back office.
It certainly is, and I think that's the second thing that the Secretary is kind of pointing at, which is we have a huge back office. It's very hard to get our arms around that back office. I found in my experience, and I worked at OMB for 5 years, in a drawdown, that probably the one most effective way to deal with that back office is to reduce the funding for it. In other words, rather than go in and say, now tell me how you're going to be more efficient, going in and saying you have 10% fewer resources next year, now find the efficiencies, is the more effective way to begin to get your arms around the size of the back office at DOD.
About a minute before our first break here, but do we need bases in Germany and Japan?
Japan, probably yes, given the fact that the administration has decided we're going to play a regional balancing role in Asia, and bases in Japan are part of that. They're also reassuring to the Japanese. Europe, somewhat more questionable, and actually the Pentagon's plan now is to bring back two brigade combat teams, two force sizes of 2,000 or 3,000 people in Europe, to the United States and to disband them. You obviously don't save money unless you bring the people out of the force structure. So as part of the plan to draw down about 100,000 soldiers, two brigade combat teams are going to come back from Europe and be disbanded. So we've been shrinking our footprint in Europe, and it looks like we quite properly are going to shrink it some more.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about defense spending, the military budget, what and where cuts can be made. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think should be cut? Do give us a call. Our guest is Gordon Adams. He's a professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University, also a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. He spent some time in the Clinton administration in the Office of Management and Budget. He writes a regular column for foreign policy, has a blog called The Sheathed Sword, and he writes for The Will and The Wallet. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages, like their sweet and tart hibiscus cranberry juice. Locations and more at TraderJoe's.com.
The sound of these voices means Christmas for so many people around the world. The men and boys of the choir of King's College, Cambridge, as they create magic each year with a festival of 9 lessons and carols. I'm Michael Barone. Don't miss our broadcast from England from American Public Media.
Monday morning at 10 on WHYY.
This week in This American Life, a Pentecostal bishop gets a revelation that everybody's going to heaven, whether they believe or not. Nobody's going to hell.
We've been sold a bill of goods. The God we've been preaching is a monster. He's worse than Saddam. He's worse than Osama bin Laden. He's worse than Hitler. Because Hitler just burned 6 million Jews, you know, but God's going to burn at least 6 billion people.
What's it like to be a modern-day heretic this week?
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
PNC Bank and the Barnes Foundation support WHYY and welcome visitors to the Barnes in Philadelphia to experience the vast collection of Picassos, Matisses, Renoirs, and Cezannes in their new home. For details on tickets and programs, barnesfoundation.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Gordon Adams about the defense budget, where the money goes, and if it can be cut without compromising national security. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Speaking of national security, should we think about future wars? And it's terrible, frankly, to even think about them, but nonetheless, this is the world that we live in. Do we think about it as an invasion of U.S. territory? Or do we think more in terms of a terrorist attack?
Well, I think what's interesting about the current era is we do not face an existential threat. There's nobody like the Soviet Union who actually threatens the survival of the United States. For somebody like me who grew up during the Cold War, that's a psychological change of enormous magnitude. The kinds of things that we're facing as a nation right now are asymmetrical, smaller, don't demand large conventional forces, but they do command some kind of a response. Terrorist attacks are obviously one of them. Here domestically, most of that responsibility falls to the FBI, the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, the folks at the border. It doesn't really fall so much to the military. Overseas, the responsibilities for dealing with terrorist organizations are scattered between state and the Treasury Department that do finances and the special operations capabilities, especially at DOD. We have quite a special operations capability. We've got 68,000 people in the special operations forces, which is bigger than the militaries of, all but a handful of countries in the world. So we've got quite a capability there, as the Osama bin Laden takedown demonstrated. So terrorist attacks, the kind of problem that people are most concerned about in the future in terms of attacks is cyber. It's the invasion of information networks in the United States. We make it a little hard on ourselves in the cyberspace because we also have one of the most developed cyber offense capabilities, which we have used against things like terrorist websites and the Iranian nuclear program. But people are worried about cyber. Now, the issue with cyber is how much of that is a military issue.
Right.
But defending the military systems is obviously the military's problem. Defending domestic systems is really the Department of Homeland Security and, in large part, the private sector, the banking, the infrastructure of the country and so on. It's all privately owned. But cyber is one of those areas that people are concerned about in the future. And way down on the horizon sometime, there's people wonder how an emerging China is going to relate to the United States globally and in the Western Pacific. Maintaining a capability there is obviously one of the objectives of the administration's policy. But the reality is we don't face a direct military threat. I had some disagreement, I must say, with Secretary Panetta's talk yesterday on this subject because he was describing a very fearful world out there. Upset and upheaval in the Middle East and Iranian nuclear capabilities and, terrorists running around the world. The reality is the actual threat to the United States and to Americans is significantly smaller than it was when I was a kid.
So does that mean we need a smaller ground force?
Well, that will be inevitably the truth. That is to say, every time we've done a drawdown, whether it was after Korea or Vietnam or at the end of the Cold War, the force that has drawn down is the ground force. We've always had that cycle in the Marines and the Army where they build up during combat times and they build down after combat times. And if you look at the line graph over history, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. It's the kind of thing you should do because one of the things you can pull back together more quickly than anything else is a ground force. You can train people in, you can deploy them very quickly. You're talking 6 months, year for an active duty capability to be deployed to Iraq, for example, which is what we were dealing with. So ground forces, yes, should probably shrink. Naval forces, my judgment, should probably stay about where they are or shrink less. Air forces can probably shrink quite a bit. We don't face a major air threat air-to-air, nor at the moment do we have countries with significant air defense capabilities that could overwhelm very superior American aircraft. But the ground force will be the most directly reduced piece of the force structure.
And what part of the ground forces do you think can be cut? If we're talking Marines, we're talking Army?
Army and Marines both. The current plan is to bring the Marines back to about, I think, 187,000 from where they are now is about 205,000. The Army is going to go down from about 570 to 490. both of those remaining forces are larger than what they were in 2001, I fully anticipate deeper drawdown on the ground forces. We've got, you know, an overall active duty military right now of about 1.4 million. I anticipate 10 years from now, you know, bar cataclysmic change abroad, it's going to be down around 1.1 million, 1.2 million. So we'll take, you know, a substantial number out.
Let me see what Brian from Fort Dix has to say. And Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. How are you
there.
Doing?
Good. How are you?
Also, thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I'm a soldier, Sergeant First Class in Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Yes.
And it's kind of a little upsetting to hear the talk on, I understand, to drop, you know, to cut soldiers, and there's a lot of soldiers in the military right now, but on the part of benefits, the benefits that we receive, I feel, is beneficial, especially the amount of, you know, as you said earlier, what we have spent our time, you know, put our lives in danger. I feel the talk should be more on if there's any cuts or benefits, more on the politicians, because I feel that they, at times, have way better, a plan or health plan than we do, you know.
Well, and
I feel that talk should be more on people that are really not, in a way, you know, putting their lives on the line, basically.
Brian, there aren't enough politicians to meet the number of people in the military.
No, I understand
but
that. I truly understand that.
Unfortunately, there's only 435.
Yeah, go ahead, Gordon Adams. But you anticipated this phone call, and it's a fair question. Gordon Adams, go ahead.
Brian's right about one thing, and that is that if I were a member of Congress for the lifetime, the health benefits and that I receive from being a member of Congress are simply marvelous. But as you said, Marty, there, you know, at one, any given point in time, there's 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate. You don't get much budgetary kick out of changing their benefits, even though I think it would be an awfully good idea. The real question here, I think, is disparity. Brian's right, and I think it's important that when we ask people to put their lives on the line, we ought to be willing to pay them what they're worth, and we ought to pay them very generous benefits. The fact is, we do that. The problem is that we now have the size of the benefits and wage package in the Department of Defense eating the budget alive when we're in the process of a build-down. So there are ways that this can be done that are equitable, that still retain significant benefits for the military, but help the department manage its resources better.
Brian, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Gordon Adams about the defense budget and where and how it could be cut. I'm wondering as well whether looking ahead, a piece of advice we could give to ourselves, which is stay out of unnecessary wars and maybe even the notion of nation building. I know a lot of the military is involved in nation building, and I think for probably a lot of very good reasons. I'm not sure it works or not, but I'd be curious about your thoughts about that.
Well, it's interesting that you asked that. You know, after every drawdown, we've had some kind of a strategic adjustment. Eisenhower drew down the ground forces, and he went to massive retaliation, you know, using the nukes to deter the Soviet Union. Nixon went from 2.5 to 1.5 wars in order to draw down the size of the force and more regional cooperation. The end of the Cold War, Colin Powell and Dick Cheney and George H.W. Bush developed something called two major regional contingencies near simultaneously. That's a mouthful.
It is.
But it basically meant Iraq and Korea at the same time, which is not something, of course, that has happened, in order to be able to plan for a smaller force by changing the strategy. Strategy always does respond to resources. You look at the risks, you figure out what you can do. What the nation-building piece has become a centerpiece of the strategic adjustment underway. Secretary Panetta's report that he put out on strategy at the beginning of 2011, the one clear strategic message it said was, we will no longer plan to keep a force that will do long-term sustained nation-building. They call them stabilization operations. In other words, we're not building a force anymore to size it around doing another Iraq. That's a strategic adjustment, and it makes a lot of sense, I think, not to be doing that. The problem that we've had with the military doing the nation-building job is that, first off, they're not terribly good at it, as the experience in Iraq and Afghanistan has suggested. They work their hearts off. God bless them.
It's really hard to do, too.
It's extraordinarily difficult to do, and most combat troops aren't really trained to that mission. It's not core to what they do. When we do that mission, and this is a second problem, we basically say we're not going to develop any capacity on the civilian side to help other countries govern themselves, so it weakens our civilian capacity. And the biggest problem, I think, with having the military do nation building is that we are stationing people in uniform in other people's countries. And while that may seem like very well-spirited and can do from our point of view, it's not always popular in other countries. Kind of says when the United States comes, they try to tell you how to govern yourself. And that's not serving our overall national security interests very well.
Let me get Hollister from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. Hollister, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wonder if your speaker could comment on two things. One is that I was really horrified to learn that the Pentagon's not accountable to Congress for its spending. It's never been audited and cannot be audited. And secondly, that the waste alone in the Pentagon, which has been compiled from several different reports from the Government Accounting Office, et cetera, is supposedly $102 billion a year, which is more than the combined budgets of the State, Interior, Commerce, Justice, and Energy Departments. I'd love to hear his comments.
Hollister, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Gordon Adams, go ahead.
Yeah, it is true. The Department of Defense, it is accountable to the Congress. Obviously, they have oversight, and the Congress has committees of authorizers and appropriators who regularly look at their budgets. But what the Congress says is absolutely right. The General Accounting Office has pointed out probably for 20 or 30 years now that the books of the Department of Defense could not pass an audit, a regular financial audit. It's an extraordinarily difficult technical thing to do. They do, for example, more than 15 to 20 million contracting actions a year. Extraordinarily difficult process to follow. They have more than 200 or 300 financial and accounting systems in the building, which work for different services and different offices, and therefore are not always compatible. There's a lot of difficulty. This is part of the problem I talked about earlier, the back office. The back office at the Pentagon is very large and not necessarily auditable by the normal business auditing financial standards because it's so huge. So every administration that I know of, including the one I served, said it was going to fix that so the Department of Defense would be auditable. And Secretary Panetta said the same by 2017. It's supposed to have a clean auditable statement. I've been around a long time. I don't expect it to happen. It's extraordinarily hard to know, however, exactly how much is waste. And the problem is one person's waste is another person's necessary program. That's always a very hard judgment to say. If you don't think a long-range bomber aircraft is something we need for our security, then you may call that waste. If you don't think you need 286 financial and accounting systems, that constitutes waste, even though every system may tell you why it needs to be different. So measuring how much that waste is really hard to do, and that's why I say probably the most effective management technique is to cut back on the allowance. That is to say, we're going to operate the back office here for less money than you've been operating it for. Now let's go and figure out how to do that more efficiently.
Hollister, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We had a caller, couldn't stay on, but concerned about this salary and benefit issue. Her concern is that private security people working for the Pentagon get paid a heck of a lot more money than those soldiers and Marines who are part of the force.
Well, they sure do, and they're not going to stay around long. That's the counterpart. You pay people who are putting themselves in danger as well, but who aren't going to be around there forever. They're in there for a contract for 6 months, 9 months, 1 year, 2 years, and then they're gone. And if you need them, you're going to pay them a premium. The advantage for the average soldier is that the average soldier is there for a career. They're going to be paid at a quite decent rate. The 4-year review that the Pentagon does of military pay and benefits says right now we are paying, on average, soldiers, sailors, airmen, at a rate that is 11% above comparable civilian counterparts factored for age and experience and education. So they're being paid reasonably well in the American economy, but they are around for a career, and we give them a basic allowance for housing and a basic allowance for consumption, and we give them variable pay depending on where they're working, and we give them health benefits that I've said are extraordinarily good, and we provide them with a lifetime retirement which they can draw after 20 years of service. So although it looks like that contracting guy out there is making out like a bandit, he's at risk and he's not going to be there for long, and he doesn't draw any of that package of income and benefits.
There are, of course, defense contracts in probably in just about every state in this country, and certainly ones here locally. And when there's talk about cutting the Pentagon budget and perhaps even cutting some of these contracts, then the issue of jobs comes up, which is that if you cut a contract, you're going to lay people off and you're going to get us back into a recession. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, because when inevitably in every drawdown, every time we've drawn down after Korea, Vietnam, end of the Cold War, every time we do this, inevitably the budget goes down. And the thing that goes down most quickly and most deeply is what the Pentagon buys outside. When it does that, it inevitably has employment consequences. There's just no way around that. That's truth. Right, you're going to draw down people and companies, the Lockheeds, the Boeings that are up there, like Berthold and so on. They're going to be shrinking their workforce. They're going to be closing production capacity. They're going to be bringing work inside they used to farm out. They're going to do all the things that a business does when its business base changes, and inevitably that means perturbation for the labor force. So I think we have to sort that out from what do we need for our national security and recognize that that is always going to be an issue. The thing that will help us most with that employment impact is not to keep spending money on things we don't need. The thing that will help most with that employment impact is having a healthy, growing American economy with a lot of investment. So solving our general economic employment, debt, and deficit problems so that we actually have a healthy, growing economy is the best thing that can happen. Labor changes happen all the time. It's just not a reason that you buy something you don't need.
A minute before we have to say goodbye here, we've been talking about where to make cuts. Where do you think we should spend more money when it comes to the defense budget?
I think the areas that will probably survive best in a drawdown are likely to be naval forces, because that's the one sort of long-term enduring American military presence around the world. Investments in areas like cyber are going to continue. People have questions about the use of drones, but I am sure the Pentagon's going to be buying more drones. Special operations forces probably will not be drawn down like other parts. Mm-hmm. Those are just four of the areas that I think are likely to survive a drawdown or even grow.
Well, on that note, Gordon Adams, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's a professor in the U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the School of International Service at American University, also a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. Spent a couple of years in the Clinton administration where he was Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs in the Office of Management and Budget. Writes a regular column for foreign policy. He blogs at the Sheathed Sword. That's hard to say. Writes for The Will and The Wallet. Coming up next, we'll be talking about what do suicide terrorists and rampage shooters have in common. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
MacArthur Theater Center in Princeton proudly supports WHYY and presents Charles Dickens' holiday classic, A Christmas Carol, now through December 28th. With veteran stage actor Graham Malcolm as Scrooge, this classic family tale celebrates the peace and goodwill of the season. Ticket information for A Christmas Carol at MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey at 609-258-2787 or online at MacArthur.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Chase, creator of The Sopranos, about his first film, Not Fade Away. Set in New Jersey in the 60s, it's about the lead singer and a high school garage band emulating the Rolling Stones and Dylan. We'll also talk with Steven Van Zandt of Springsteen's band, the movie's music supervisor. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Mm-hmm. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have an unflinching look at homelessness from three budding writers who tell their own stories. Also, we'll have the latest in the rippling effects of the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. The shocking murders and suicide in Newtown, Connecticut have raised troubling questions about why anyone would kill first graders and teachers in an elementary school. Adam Langford wrote a piece in the New York Times earlier this week about some of the similarities between suicide terrorists and rampage shooters. He's a criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama, where his research focuses on aggression and violence, counterterrorism, and international security, author of a book coming out titled The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. Adam Langford, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to speak with you, Marty.
It's such a tough thing to talk about, don't you think?
Absolutely.
You talk about, and I wanted to sort of take apart the piece you had in the New York Times. You begin by talking about suicide terrorists. And these, of course, are terrorists that we know that will go into a market and blow themselves up and kill people in that market for what we generally think of as for political or ideological beliefs and reasons. You say it's more complicated than that.
Absolutely. The thing is, it's pretty easy to understand in retrospect why they want to be viewed as these politically and religiously committed martyrs. That makes them seem like they're part of a greater cause, and that rather than having mental health problems, that they just are so committed to their beliefs that they're willing to do whatever it takes. And the reality is that's all a mask, that's a myth. It's a cover for what is actually going on. They have an underlying death wish. They're suffering deeply inside. They want to die, and they want to take other people with them.
So they are actually suicidal or have suicidal ideations?
Absolutely, yes. It's pretty clear. You know, I've gone through suicide notes, martyrdom videos. I've looked at quotes from families. The evidence is all over the place, and it really corresponds with what we see with other people who just commit suicide all around the world.
So clinical depression, things like that?
Clinical depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, schizophrenia, all those kind of things.
But I think the question is, again, so difficult to talk about, but for, let's say, a suicide terrorist, why kill other people?
Most of the time, that person's suffering very deeply inside. They have their own psychological pain, and they blame that pain on someone else. So in the case of suicide terrorists, they're blaming it, and in part because they've been told by terrorist organizations and their propaganda to think this way, they blame their pain on Western infidels or the Israeli government or something like that, basically saying that all my problems are your fault. And we see the same kind of thing with rampage shooters. It's just that instead of blaming the government or the infidels, they're blaming the school system or their workplace or their parents or something like that.
In fact, you say there are some common traits that you have observed between these rampage killers, such as the person we observed or who killed all those people in Connecticut on Friday. A connection between these rampage killers and suicide terrorists.
Yes. In fact, I recently did a study of all suicide terrorists and rampage shooters, workplace shooters, and school shooters, all of them who attacked in the U.S. between 1990 and 2010, and they were almost interchangeable. In other words, you know, the specifics of the case varied, but they had a lot of the same underlying factors, despite the differences in what they claimed they were attacking for.
As I began, we're all trying to make sense about what happened in Connecticut, about why somebody would kill first graders, and that's what I think we're all struggling with.
Yeah, it's brutal.
It is brutal.
One of the ways I think about it is that most people who commit murder, suicide, and that's what we're talking about here,
right,
most of the time, their targets, the targets for their rage, are people they know. And in Adam Lanza's case, his mother, obviously, he knew and apparently had some deep resentment against. What's unusual is people who commit murder, suicide against strangers. And in most of those cases, these attackers are trying to get social recognition. They're trying to get attention, fame, and glory. And they realize that by killing random, innocent people, they'll get everyone to pay attention.
We should say that most people with some form of mental illness do not kill people and are not violent.
Absolutely. And frankly, they don't. Most people who have mental illness, they don't commit suicide.
Right.
They don't blame their problems on others. You know, there's plenty of healthy ways to cope with that and good ways to get treatment.
And most people do some form of that.
Absolutely.
So we're talking, obviously, we're talking about a very small but unique group of individuals.
It's really an aberration, fortunately.
There is also, as you wrote, the sense of victimization. How does that factor in?
Well, it gets to that issue where people who are suffering are blaming their problems on others. Mm-hmm. And one of the remarkable things I found is these interviews with people who carried out suicide bombings, and they were complaining about how they felt like they were being bullied and oppressed and persecuted by, in these particular cases, it was Israeli soldiers. And the statements they made about how they felt bullied and disrespected were almost identical to the kind of statements made by Columbine shooters, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, who complained that they were getting picked on by jocks and bullies at their school. Now the way mental illness factors in is sometimes those perceptions of being a victim are not completely accurate. They're inflamed, exaggerated, right. Distorted.
But what you're saying is the political and the personal are become one and the same.
Well, I guess what I would say is that it's always the personal that matters more. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the political and the personal blur in the attacker's mind, but without those personal problems, there are plenty of people who have radical political ideologies who would never think of personally carrying out these attacks.
And as you say, a desire for what, fame, glory, even and martyrdom, even in death?
Yes. My sense is that these individuals often fantasize about fame and glory and increased social status. They fantasize about those things as a solution to all their problems. It'll help them find love, find job, find meaning in life. And eventually they give up on that. But when they give up on that, they think, well, I'm going out, I've given up on life, but at least I'll be remembered as famous and someone who mattered after my death.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Adam Lankford. He's a criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama. His research focuses on aggression, violence, counterterrorism, and international security. He's got a forthcoming book, The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. And he wrote a piece in the New York Times earlier this week titled What Drives Suicidal Mass Killers, obviously in response to what happened in Connecticut on Friday. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Of course, this desire for fame and glory raises questions about how we cover these incidents, how we talk about them. Do you have thoughts about that, Adam?
Well, I do. I guess the first thing I would say is we shouldn't rush to blame the media. Certainly, you know, the blame is with the perpetrators. But that being said, one example that comes to mind is, what do we do about people who run on the field at a baseball game or at a football game? Well, TV networks have made a calculated decision and perhaps a principled decision not to show those individuals. Mm. If you're sitting at home and someone runs on the field, they show other things, but they do not show the person who ran on the field because they know that person's seeking attention. So it's possible, at least, and although it has not been tested, that if you gave less attention, if you didn't, for instance, release the names and faces of these individuals who carry out these horrific crimes, that they would find it less attractive. They would indulge in these fantasies of fame and glory less often.
Because there can be these copycat acts that happen after these rampages.
Yes, there can. And frankly, you know, the kind of cold, hard truth is that when you look at people like the Columbine shooters, what else could they have done that would have gotten their faces on Time magazine? Very few things. They certainly couldn't have kind of snapped their fingers and gotten their faces on the front cover of Time magazine any other way than by doing these terrible things.
Even posthumously.
Right, right. That's right.
Let me get, it looks like Pat from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. And Pat, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I totally agree with keeping names and faces off the air. But I want to talk a little bit about how we got here in the first place and disenfranchisement in general and the little tiny bit of tolerance that we have for any deviation from one millionth of a standard deviation from the norm. I heard him, this shooter, described several times on the air by people very, very dismissively. I even saw a wave of a hand one time saying he was off, he was a little different. Does that make it okay for us to ostracize or to, obviously mine is conjecture like yours, but I have a child who is a little off, and he has been dismissed, and he has been, truthfully, has been the only kid in the class left out of a birthday party, or he has been ostracized and just left out and really hip-checked into the wall to point out to him that he was really nothing. And, you know, so this is on a micro scale.
Sure.
We could talk about Camden and the kids there that feel disenfranchised. And how do we make a place at the table for everyone
so
that no one has to feel this lonely and this desperate?
I really appreciate your call, and I think you touch on such an important issue about, you know, kids that don't get picked and don't get invited to birthday parties. And I don't want to make too big a link here or leap here, but Adam Langford, I'd be curious about your thoughts, your response.
Well, what I would point out is that when people are suicidal or people have mental illness and people struggle with depression, there's a tendency to assume that that's all internal, that it's all about something that's wrong inside of them. And as the caller suggested, external factors, mm-hmm. how we treat these people, does have a major effect on their psychology, just like it has an effect on my psychology or your psychology. So I talk about in the op-ed piece I did for the New York Times, I talk about perceived victimization.
Yes.
Because really, it's the perception of the victimization that matters, but that doesn't mean it's not real. Sometimes it is real victimization, and whoever's doing the bullying or leaving people out do bear some responsibility for not acting more humanely.
Well, Pat, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I do want to get back to our callers. But, Adam, I was thinking about this thing called suicide by cop, which in some of these instances, an individual will, in a sense, put himself in a situation where rather than committing suicide, he in a sense, forces the police to shoot him. I'd be curious about your thoughts about that.
Well,
that dynamic, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. You certainly see that in a lot of these cases. I've studied 179 cases over the last 50 years, and overall, when people die at the scene of the crime, about 80% of the time, they're putting a gun to their head and pulling the trigger, and the other 20% of the time, they may be engaging in this kind of suicide by cop. They're being mm-hmm. shot and killed by the police. And a lot of times when you look at their suicide notes, that's what they planned. But it puts the police officers in a really
sure.
tough situation because these people who commit suicide by cop, they want to die really just as much as other suicidal people, but they're putting the burden on these police officers. They're shooting at police officers, putting them in danger, and sometimes the officers who are the ones who put these people down, they have their own kind of nightmares to deal with.
How did you get interested in this?
Well, I was in college on 9/11, just graduating from undergrad and going to a doctoral program. So I knew I was going to be studying criminal psychology, and I felt like that was kind of a call to action to branch out to terrorist psychology as well.
I wonder too, and just thinking about the world that we live in. There's propaganda, there are violent movies, there are video games. I mean, it's a very stimulating environment that the world that we live in. Do you think that's a factor as well?
Well, in terms of video games, one of the things to look at is desensitization. If people begin to get desensitized and they feel like, oh, violence isn't that big a deal, this thing that used to scare me doesn't scare me as much, that can have an effect. On the other hand, you know, there is a difference between virtual reality and real reality. You know, people who play video games may still be kind of shaking like a leaf if they're asked or push themselves to act in the real world the way they might be comfortable behind a computer screen.
In fact, that's probably true for most people.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's only kind of so much that virtual reality reflects the real thing.
Well, Adam Langford, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama, author of a forthcoming book titled The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. And he wrote a piece earlier this week in the New York Times, What Drives Suicidal Mass Killers. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back. Spending the hour talking about war and violence. Coming up next, our guest is Yale University's John